Last week on the Bat Segundo Show, it was revealed that our fearless host had made his way into an institution where two professionals believed him to be a murder suspect. But it turns out that this was not the case at all.
Mr. Segundo, 2 years ago you impersonated a woman.
Not so! Although I once almost impregnated a woman.
Mr. Segundo.
Just ask my ex-wife.
This was a journalistic exercise?
That's a very personal question. I don't see how it's any of your business. Wait a minute, your voice is very familiar.
Yes, you said that last time. And now you want us to check you in.
I didn't say that at all!
Mr. Segundo, just so we understand each other, we're professionals here at the Arkham Asylum.
Is that the real name of this place?
No, it's a pseudonym. Mr. Segundo, would you consider yourself angry?
What are you talking about? The Blackguards are all conspiring against me! You're conspiring against me!
Voluntary commitment, then.
What's the alternative?
Writing a book about these issues you're having.
That won't do at all! Okay, where do I sign myself away?
Okay, so I am here. We have Nora Vincent, who is the author of Self-Made Man and most recently, Voluntary Madness. Nora, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Matt is in the center of both of your titles. Is that a coincidence, or?
No, I guess not.
Okay, well, I wanted to first of all start off, I suppose we should talk about the history of mental health in this nation. Reagan, of course, when he was governor of California, signed the Lanterman Parish Short Act, and of course that made it harder to commit people. And this in turn caused the mentally ill to be, unfortunately, cast into the streets, in prisons, and in jails and the like. This also caused a national tilt to the way that this nation deals with healthcare. And mental health care, obviously. I'm wondering, how much do you think an institutional dilemma along these lines has possibly affected what you observed in the three institutions that you were in? To what degree do you feel that governmental policy is something that essentially dictates or steers people and prevents psychiatrists from revolting with the munificent care that you champion in this particular book? What of this?
Well, I mean, certainly I observed in the first place that homelessness is very much a mental illness problem, more so even than maybe a poverty problem. I think this is something that people talked about a lot with regard to this this act that you're talking about that Reagan passed, the deinstitutionalization, essentially. I think the biggest problem that I observed, and I don't know yet what the way around this is because it's complicated, but the biggest problem was this kind of revolving door of these homeless people who get picked up on the street for, I don't know, disturbing the peace, and then they find their way into these places and they get very heavily medicated, and then they get put back right back out on the street, and then they usually go off their meds because the side effects of a lot of them are pretty awful, and then they just get rearrested at some point and they end up back there. So the way I observed it, it's not working very well because it's costing people a lot of money to put these people away continuously. It doesn't seem to be doing them any real good because they continue to come back. But what that's going to entail then is some kind of a program that's going to address the bigger problems in their lives, to give them some kind of greater access to outpatient facilities or individual therapy, community support. I mean, this is something, interestingly, in terms of public policy, if you think about someone like Marvin Alasky, who used to argue about the more community approach to dealing with poverty, I think a similar approach with mental illness might be very successful, and that is for a community to take responsibility for the mentally ill people within that community and to say, okay, we need to give this person some place to be, we can't just take this person and shut them away for a few months while they're in their most florid psychotic states. We should try to take the burden on ourselves as a community, share it in the community, and give this person a sense of belonging, which can, I think, go a long way, at least from what I observed, in helping especially psychotic people to be more high-functioning.
But when you were in Meriwether the last day, it was this immense bureaucratic process to actually get out, and you actually had to flag down someone to essentially get out into the streets and the like. So given that reality, how can some of these more community-based services find fruition in these rather stolid and obdurate systems that currently exist?
Well, I think that's going to be the biggest problem. I mean, any kind of getting anything done in these places, you know, they're huge bureaucracies. They suffer from all the problems of most public institutions, and there's a lot of waste. And you're right. I think getting them to change anything and address problems is just, it's a task that would take so much patience. It's certainly much more patience than I have, and determination. I just have to continue cracking and cracking and trying to get at the way things are done, which is always how you, what you'll hear in these places. Yeah. Well, that's not how it's done. You know, no one's willing to sort of step up and say, this is clearly not working. We need to do something better.
Well, I also wanted to ask you, because you do point out that it costs $14,000 to stay for 2 weeks at St. Luke's and Meriwether, which is essentially the cost of staying at the Ritz-Carlton. I'm wondering why you didn't really probe into why it costs so much to stay in these particular places, or if this was something that was not necessarily part of the emphasis of the book, or did you actually try to research this, or what happened? Did no one want to actually tell you why everything costs so much? Or?
Well, that wasn't really the focus of the book. I mean, I think that would have been a more institutional kind of expose, and while in part this was that, it was really more, my style of journalism is to throw myself into something and give you the patient's eye, the personal view of, hey, I went and did this, this is how it feels to be there. I wanted to include things like the cost because I thought it would be of interest, but yeah, you'd have to do a lot more digging than I did to find out why. I mean, I got somewhat itemized bills, and it's pretty appalling what they'll charge for, you know, to take blood when you're in, or, you know, and also you have to remember a lot of the things that they offer to do, you know, like they'll say, well, we could do a CAT scan to, you know, find out such and such. That CAT scan alone is going to cost an unbelievable amount of money, and it may not really have been necessary, or let's say if you had known, if you were paying out of pocket, you certainly would have said, let's forego the CAT scan.
Yeah.
And I think the insurance companies, you know, are eventually going to start saying, and have started saying the same thing, you know, look, we need to keep it to a minimum. But you're right. I mean, I don't have the exact itemized information to tell you how much everything costs, except that I know that, you know, each night costs a certain amount of money, say like $1,200. That, you know, that alone, what pays for that? I mean, I guess you're paying for everybody who's there, the social workers, you know, and there are, yeah, there's a lot of people that I observed that probably shouldn't have been there. They're probably overstaffed in some ways, except that I suppose you could argue some of these people who may be sitting around are needed in a kind of an emergency. If somebody freaks out, you know, then the five people would come on the ward in the purple rubber gloves and, you know, take care of the thing. So maybe that's why a lot of these people are kind of sitting around.
And you can't exactly take the bill and go for a line item approach saying, oh, well, that's not really worth the cost and et cetera. This is interesting also because your health insurance carrier refused to allow you to pay for your stays at these respective institutions. And I wanted to ask whether there were any efforts on your part after the book was done or was recently published to try to pay them back in any capacity. I mean, it seems to me that an insurance company would want money, you know?
Yeah, well, you would think so. I mean, I did try very hard. I you know, I wasn't particularly eager to part with $30,000 if I didn't have to, but I wanted to do, you know, I wanted to show that I was making an effort, and I did feel that it was my research, therefore I should pay for it. So I did make several calls and talked to several different people in different departments, and I actually had a therapist from the insurance company call me to find out. She admitted, my explicit reason for calling you is to find out if you are in fact sane, because there are people who will call and say what you're saying, which is essentially, I didn't really need to be there because they don't want it on their records or for whatever other reason. And so I think she really thought that I didn't have a legitimate reason. And you can imagine it sounds a little strange if you say you're writing a book and so on. And while they could have Googled my name, you know, I guess they apparently never did. And I could never get from them. I said, I want to send you a check, but I'm not going to just send it to nobody and have it get lost. And I want to have proof that I paid the right people and get a receipt and so on. And I could never nail them down for that. So
any follow-up efforts at any time to try to pay them back? Or they haven't actually contacted you now that you've talked about the book saying, hey, I didn't pay and I was doing this for research purposes?
Yeah, well, I haven't done it since. I tried, you know, the first couple of times, but you know, I guess I could try again after the, you know, publication. Well, it's possible. I certainly could.
Fair enough. Well, I also wanted to ask you alluded to the kind of journalism you practice, which Some have called, I suppose, submergence journalism. I prefer to, I suppose, call it experiential journalism. Are there any particular disadvantages or even advantages to what you do? Because for one thing, you do keep all of the people who you have talked with anonymous, so there's no way to independently corroborate what you determined. So I'm wondering, do you find any particular advantages or disadvantages to this particular type of journalism, and why do you sometimes resist plunging further into what I suppose could even be a more well-rounded piece of journalism for this, for these two books?
I guess because that's not the kind of journalism that interests me so much, and a lot of other people do that. I mean, a lot of other people have written books, for example, about the pharmaceutical industry or about the mental health system that are that kind of a book. And for me, I guess I like erasing that line between, I like to, rather than going and do a bunch, I mean, I usually do quite a bit of research before I go in, but I like the experience of just diving into something, seeing what it feels like to live that life and writing about it from my own point of view. That's just what appeals to me as a person, I guess. It's obviously not what everyone would do, and you might even say it isn't really journalism, that it's more, or that it's a specific arm of journalism that's more like memoir, which is really, I guess it gives me a lot of latitude. You know, it means that I can relate my own experience. I can put it in the context of whatever environment I put myself in. And I can draw some conclusions that I never proposed to be scientific conclusions, but that I feel are valid because they're based on an experience. And usually what ends up happening is a lot of people say, yeah, I've had that experience too. Other people might say, well, that's not my experience, but I'm not trying to make an argument. I did that when I wrote op-eds. I did the whole, I'm going to make an argument and convince you of something in 750 words. And I find that less interesting because I feel that there's so much I don't know. I'd rather ask the questions. I'd rather kind of prod and poke and get people to think about things in a different way rather than sort of say, here's the evidence, this is the conclusion you should draw.
But you're not interested in essentially getting like an answer to, say, this notion of like, where does the money go in terms of the $14,000?
Not really. I mean, I guess, you know, again, there are people who can and have pursued that. That's not, yeah, I'm much more interested in people's stories. I'm interested in the personal experience of being in a mental institution. I'm interested in what it feels like to take these drugs, to try to get off these drugs. And those are much more amorphous questions. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the direction of my interest. Again, people might say, well, the people that you talk to in these institutions, how do you know their stories are true? I don't know they're true. They're their stories, but that's what interests me is how do they frame their own story and how do I frame my own story? And that's what I guess I find more compelling than saying, okay, well, this is the itemized list of why this cost what it cost. And that's just a very different style, and it's not mine.
Do you set any particular limits on what you will write about and how you will write about something? I mean, obviously what you're doing is a different kind of journalism, and I guess this leads me to ask about what your ethical core in terms of what journalism is about. You know, is there a certain act of betrayal perhaps in not telling someone initially whether you're doing this for a book or whether you're doing this for a piece of writing or whatnot? I mean, what limits do you set for something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always a certain deception when you do these things because the whole point is that you're trying to be under the radar. You don't want people to know that you're a journalist because as soon as they know that, they change what they tell you, you know, and the idea is to see people in their own environments and to be in their environments with them and have it all be as if nobody were listening. And that's also, by the way, why I always change the names of every person and every place and really try to disguise it, because I'm not interested in embarrassing anybody. I'm just interested in getting at what people tend to be a little more honest, I guess, when they feel that no one's listening.
I wanted to actually quote something. This kind of leads into one of the many thrusts of your book, and that is your quibbling with the term diagnosis. You write, "There are no diagnoses in psychiatry, only umbrella terms for observed patterns of complaint, groupings of symptoms given names, and oversimplified and assigned what are probably erroneous causes because these erroneous causes can be medicated. And then both the drug and the supposed disease are made legitimate, and thus the profession, as well as the patient, legitimized too by these magical words going hand in hand to the insurance company, diagnosis, and it's not your fault." But if there are no diagnoses in psychiatry, well, where is the starting point? I mean, obviously you have to start somewhere and identify a particular problem, even on a simplistic level, in order to help another person. So what of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the difficulty, I guess, is that right now we don't have a test that can tell you you've got bipolar disorder or you've got any number of, I mean, all of these so-called illnesses, which I don't doubt are real entities. Clearly, when you see enough of these patients, you see the patterns that they're describing, and people who are schizophrenic tend to be paranoid, all these various things. That it's not that the groupings are illegitimate in that way or the observation's wrong. It's just that it does leave an enormous gray area, and it means that you can diagnose somebody as having this thing without any really concrete way of knowing that they do in fact have it. And I think that can lead to a lot of problems, such that, for example, people, again, have written a lot about the way that diagnoses of depression have, I don't know, tripled in the last 10 or 15 years. And I think you have to ask yourself, how many of those people have something that's a pathological depression? Or is it a situational depression? And not being able to distinguish between those two things is, I think, problematic.
You're talking about largely the specific difference between someone who is psychotic, who is merely someone who cannot distinguish between reality and their imagination and their dreams, and is not necessarily violent, versus someone who is psychopathic, who is going to be prone to violent behavior and the like. Certainly, there has to be some degree in which we have to prevent people from harming themselves or harming other particular people. I agree with you that psychotic does, in fact, get a bad rap, but nevertheless, there is this larger term of people who are, in fact, going to be committing violent behavior. And so I'm wondering, you know, why quibble with the notion, as you do in one of the interim moments in the book, about this impression of so-called psychotics in movies and everything, when in fact there are dangerous people out there.
Oh yeah, and there's no question that right now medication and in some cases putting these people in an environment where they can't hurt people is all we have. It's the best that we have right now. I would hope that someday we will have medications, for example, that can specifically address what's going wrong in the brain of a schizophrenic person. And that's just something we don't have right now. We don't know. We don't understand the mechanism of schizophrenia or what appears to be. There again is the question, well, you may appear to be schizophrenic, but without a test that can tell us, we don't actually know whether you are or not, or whether you're manifesting symptoms that, you know, like that may be entirely something else, an allergy. I mean, you know, think about if you were to go to the hospital and say, I'm having terrible chest pains, and you were assuming you were having a heart attack, and there was no way to know whether it was that or it was indigestion. I mean, there are a lot of symptoms that can be caused by various different things, and I think that's the part that's missing for us right now.
But there is also something to be said, even though, yes, antipsychotic drugs are certainly not the cure-all or the absolute remedy, but if you're talking about a situation in which someone could be prevented from hurting themselves or other people, aren't
then
they?
There's no question we have to do that. That's the best we have right now. And I just only hope that it will get better so that the medications may not be doing other damage in order to achieve the result that we want.
But is the notion of taking someone who is psychopathic, locking them up and doping them up with antipsychotic drugs, you view this as the best solution right now? Or do you think that perhaps talking with them, as you advocate in this particular book, is a better solution than that?
Well, I mean, there's you know, again, books out there that have explored this, for example, and I don't have the statistics right at my fingertips, but argue that schizophrenics tend to fare better in the third world than they do in this part of the world, because they aren't given medication and because so much of the treatment is about community support. Now, whether, you know, obviously I don't think that's a cure-all, and I don't think we can do without some form of medication right now. I mean, for some people, that's just, as I say, the best we have. But I don't think that we should abandon the idea that someone who's schizophrenic could benefit greatly from things that are other than just medicating the hell out of them and locking them away.
Yeah.
So I'm conceding both points, that sometimes that's necessary and that's what we have to do. But I would like to hope that there's a whole range of treatments that we can encourage, and that also when you incarcerate someone and over-medicate them, they're probably not very likely to get better. They're not very likely to get better in a long-lasting way, so that we need to make some adjustment to allow that to happen.
Okay. I actually have to wonder about the idea of presenting a solution or a possible solution through empiricism. Yes, I agree with you that arrogance in any institutional form is certainly a cancerous plague upon getting solutions. Nevertheless, if you take away that arrogance and consider the knowledge base that trained medical authorities do have, is there not some value in a trained doctor who is on the cutting edge of current medical technology saying, well, you know, this may not be the best solution? Or are you really quibbling more with this character of the arrogant doctor who doesn't inform the patient as to what they're getting and what potential side effects?
You have to understand that a lot of these people are not on the cutting edge and aren't very well informed. I mean, you know, for example, you can go to, and a lot of people do get their meds prescribed by a GP. This person is not particularly, I mean, they can be, but it's not a given that they're that well informed. And that's the part that scares me. And in my experience going to psychiatrists, yeah, the part about not informing people, it's, you know, the question comes up repeatedly, well, what's so bad about taking medication? And I'm not saying it's bad, it's a personal choice.
Yeah.
But in order to make that choice, you need to be as fully informed as you can be. And I know for my part and many other people I know, they've been prescribed these medications for a whole range of sometimes very minor complaints, sometimes not so minor, but they've never really been told. It's just the assumption is, I'm giving you this, I know that it's best for you. I'm not going to tell you the things you might want to know, which is that, you know, do a little research, maybe find out that sometimes a fair number of people have trouble getting off of some of these when they want to. It's hard to get off, or that you might experience these side effects, and if that's okay with you, terrific. But so it's not a question of saying, trying to scare people away from taking them, but only to say, you know, there isn't as much knowledge out there as we'd like to think. I mean, a lot of these people, for example, in the first hospital I went to, they wanted to give me this drug that they thought was so great, and I said, well, what neurotransmitter does that work on? And they said, well, we're not sure, we'll have to look it up and we'll get back to you. So if you're prescribing a medication and you don't even know what it does, I don't know, that's a little worrisome to me.
Yeah. But simultaneously, let's say there is a particular doctor who does, in fact, know what the medication is doing. Are there circumstances that you would agree with in which this doctor, treating perhaps someone who is psychopathic, should not necessarily inform the psychopathic what they're actually getting, saying that this is good for them, because there, of course, is going to be some kind of recalcitrance for a particular drug that may, in fact, help them to get better?
Well, that's a difficult question, because right now, for example, there's only so much knowledge about what the drugs do. So even somebody who purports to know all of what it's doing, that's just, they don't. I mean, none of us do. You know, we don't know. But also, you're right. I mean, there's a difficult middle ground when you're trying to help somebody who's delusional, and how much of a conversation can you have with them about their treatment? But then there is the question of, well, if you're giving somebody medication, you know, that you don't necessarily, you're not explaining to them what it does. I mean, it's that same ground with any procedure. Doing something without someone's consent, when is that okay and under what circumstances, and can we do better about that? You know, I mean, it's a hard question. I don't have an easy answer. I think you would agree. It's a difficult middle ground.
But the doctor could, in fact, point a finger in your direction and say, well, she's essentially kind of doing the same thing with her journalism. Is that not the same?
The same thing in the sense that I'm poking at them and saying, we need to tell people more, or we need to ask this question. I'm not trying to come to a conclusion. I'm trying to say, shouldn't we be asking ourselves, under what circumstances is it okay to give people these meds, and is it always the best solution, and are we offering viable alternatives? Are we working on them? Are we admitting what we don't know? Are we telling people what they need to know in other circumstances? Let's consider the people not on the margins. Let's talk about the whole swath of people who are prescribed antidepressants every year, who are entirely capable of knowing and understanding what they may or may not do to them, and being able to make an informed decision. I think a lot of that isn't happening. So to ask the question, hey, wouldn't this be better practice to really tell people about this? I don't know. I'm not coming to a conclusion, but I am raising a question that I think is legitimate.
This next question may have a lot to do with what you just answered, but I do want to present the dilemma nonetheless. You observe Karen in St. Luke's as an example of a high-functioning psychotic. At St. Luke's, she was able to get reality checks through a supportive community, and this was something that those in Meriwether couldn't get. And while she proved to be more reachable and more vociferous about her problem, you know, pointing to her head, saying, "I hear the voices still in my head," and the like, I'm wondering if... you were able to conclude that these so-called reality checks actually improved her condition, because you do point out also that she was a person who was a repeat visitor who constantly came in to get, you know, her meds looked at, to check her condition and all that. Is it a matter of her being happier or her condition improving? I mean, what is the specific criteria here as to why that is good?
Why what is good?
You know, this particular treatment of a reality check and a supportive community.
Oh. Well, I think it certainly can't but help. I mean, if you take somebody, anybody, you took you or me, and you put us out on the street, like a lot of the people that I met in the first place, the public hospital, you're going to lose some amount of touch with reality. You're going to be frightened. You're going to be pushed to the edge. All those things are going to put a lot of stressors on your mind and undoubtedly make your state of mind worse. So if you're already starting out as somebody who's schizophrenic or has tendencies in that direction, it's just going to make it worse. So the same thing applies in the other direction. If you've got somebody who's already got this challenge, they've got to deal with this, and they're never going to be somebody who's not going to have to work at it and not probably going to have to take meds or just constantly be vigilant about it. But it doesn't mean that they aren't much better off than they might have been if they didn't have people to reach out and talk to, people to check in with. As I say, in my experience, you say, well, she came back. Yeah, of course, she had to come back because I think she's always going to be managing this. There's no way around that. But I think that from what I saw, she was functioning at a better level. She came back less often. You know, she probably was there maybe, I don't even know how often she was there, but I know it wasn't every month like some of these people.
But I'm wondering if there was a way to possibly talk with the doctor who was treating her to sort of ask, I don't know, or possibly sort of sneakily ask in some way, did she get better? I mean, was there an absolute change in her condition? Did the psychosis whittle down? That's the kind of the question I'm asking here.
Well, and I mean, I certainly have talked to doctors about that who will say, you know, the medications can do quite a lot in terms of tamping down. You know, they rarely get rid of them entirely, if ever. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard a doctor say, yeah, you know, they're going to be completely without any problems at all if they take this medication. I think it makes it less, it's less in the forefront. You know, like the way I heard it described is when they're not on the meds, it's like a loud radio right in the room. When they're on the meds, it's like a lower level radio in the next room. You know, so that's kind of what we're dealing with right now, which again is another reason why hopefully we can find something better. Wouldn't it be great if we could find something that would eradicate the voices altogether?
Well, Nora, thanks very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.